said. A few months. I hate to close the doors, but the lawyer police will probably force me to shut it down pretty soon.
Lawyer police?
The Board of Professional Responsibility.
What do they have to do with this?
Since a federal judge has declared me a danger to the community, I guarantee you they'll do the same thing. They'll shut my practice down and Rachel will be on the street.
Darren,
Mom said, almost in a whisper.
The FBI has come to talk to me a couple of times. They're coming to my shop in the middle of the day. They're scaring my help and my customers.
I shook my head.
I'm sorry, Mom. They're threatening me, Darren. They're threatening to arrest me as a co-conspirator, or as an accessory. They're saying they'll subpoena me to a grand jury if I don't talk to them.
They probably will, I said. But they've already indicted me. Dragging you in front of a grand jury won't do them much good.
What do you want me to do if I get a subpoena?
Tell them the truth, Mom. Just tell them the truth. I knew the sheriff's department listened in and occasionally recorded conversations in the visiting booths, and I figured I was probably a top-priority candidate.
So, you want me to tell them about—
I held up my hand. The truth, I said. I'm going to have to tell the jury what happened when we go to trial. You do the same thing. Okay? She nodded and put her hand on the glass. I covered it with my own.
Okay,
she said.
Then you believe the truth will set you free?
It has to, Mom. I don't think I can deal with the alternative.
I love you, Darren. Stay strong.
I love you, too. Chapter 29. As the days and nights dragged endlessly by, I found myself becoming more and more feral. I was locked up in my 63-square-foot concrete box 23 hours a day, sometimes 24. When they let me out for recreation, I was simply moved to a 10-foot-by-10-foot steel mesh cage just outside the cell block that had a phone on the wall. There was another cage next to it, and every once in a while, they'd bring another inmate in, but I ignored them. To me, they were enemies, placed in the cage by Clancy or the sheriff for the sole purpose of engaging me in conversation so they could later appear in court and testify that I had confessed. All of the simple pleasures of life that I'd taken for granted, going to work, sleeping in a comfortable bed, taking long hot showers, eating decent food, feeling the sun on my face, marveling at the beauty of the moon, having a beer with colleagues, playing with Sean, talking, were gone. I was living an existence so different from what I'd known, so utterly deprived of normal stimulation, I sometimes feared for my sanity. At first I tried to console myself with the thought that I'd be out soon, but thinking about being out made being in even worse, so I stopped. I thought about Sean often, but that too was painful, and before too long, I found it difficult to remember what he looked like. The guards left me pretty much alone after those first few weeks, especially after the story about Jalen Jordan being a child killer broke. I had a cell to myself, so I stopped calling them names and challenging them every 2 or 3 days. The only exception was the Joe DuBose hire that I'd headbutted my first day on the block. His name was Belcher. It was stitched into his black uniform right above the pocket on the left side of his chest, and he seemed to derive a great deal of pleasure from calling me faggot.
Rec time, faggot. Here's your supper, faggot. Why don't you ever say anything anymore, faggot? Please, faggot, give me a reason to come in there and whip your ass.
I ignored the taunts, which I suspect made him hate me even more, but given the circumstances, there really wasn't much more he could do to me. After about a month in isolation, I quit shaving. I hadn't had a haircut in a while and saw no reason to make arrangements. There was a civilian barber who would come to the block and cut hair every 2 weeks. I became used to the rats and the roaches. I even spoke to them on occasion, and I became used to the mold on the walls and the foul-tasting water. I became used to feeling unclean, to taking only one shower a week, and to eating food barely fit for human consumption. I became used to the extreme changes in temperature inside the cell block. I became used to the constant din of men in close confinement who are scared and uncertain, and who express their fear either by yelling or singing or moaning or fighting or simply by banging their fists against the metal in the cells. I took refuge occasionally in the books my mother sent me, but I found it difficult to concentrate. I became terrified of fire breaking out in the cell block. I did push-ups and crunches and pull-ups. I shadow-boxed for hours at a time. It wasn't conscious, but I seemed to be preparing myself for something both mentally and physically. War, perhaps? I called my mother on Thursdays when they let me out of the cell if the phones were working, but as time went by, we had less and less to say to each other. Katie was fighting her hard over being able to see Sean. She'd spent thousands of dollars on a lawyer, supposedly a friend of mine, and still hadn't even been granted a court date. As for the divorce, I'd filed a handwritten answer to the petition for divorce and had managed to get a judge to agree to postpone the proceedings until after my trial. I knew if I was convicted, I'd probably never see Sean again. Grace came to see me once a week and would give me updates on the case. It wasn't going well, she said. James Tipton had refused to talk to her investigator, and when the investigator pressed the issue, Tipton threatened to shoot him. We had no idea what his testimony would be, but we figured it had to be something about me trying to hire him to kill Jordan. Grace's investigator had also found the witness named Hobart Godsey. As it turned out, his nickname was Hillbilly, and he'd been in the cell with me at Blount County. Both Grace and I knew what that meant. Ben Clancy would call him at trial to say I admitted to shooting Jalen Jordan. Hillbilly, the hypocritical bastard, was going to be their jailhouse snitch. Grace also told me that Clancy had expert witnesses lined up to testify. One was a ballistics expert who was going to testify that the bullet that killed Jalen Jordan came from a rifle that FBI agents found near the crime scene. The other was a fingerprint expert who apparently was going to testify that my fingerprints had been found on some money that had been turned over to the feds by James Tipton. I didn't understand why that mattered if they were trying to prove that I'd committed the murder, and Clancy wasn't telling Grace any more than he absolutely had to. We went to court a couple of times for motions, and I sat there listening as the lawyers fought over the rules by which we would conduct the trial for my life. The most important motion was the one Ben Clancy filed, asking the court to order that no mention would be made of the fact that the underwear found in Jalen Jordan's van had indeed contained DNA that matched the two murdered boys. Judge Gear granted the motion, and as much as I hated to admit it, he was probably right. Our defense wasn't that I killed Jalen Jordan because he was a killer of children and had threatened my child. Our defense was that I hadn't killed him at all. Still, allowing the jury to hear that Jalen was a budding serial killer of children would most likely have prejudiced the jury and may have caused them to let me go because they thought he needed killing, no matter who had done it. The week before the trial started, Grace came to see me on a Wednesday. The clean, fresh smell of her was almost overwhelming. I smiled at her and tried not to stare. Sometimes when she came to the cell, I had to force myself not to look at her because I knew there was hunger in my eyes, and I didn't want her to see it. She was leaning against the sink while I sat on the edge of the bed frame. "I'm sending a barber in here on Friday," she said. "You need to go back to your lawyer look. Clean shaven, short hair. I want you looking good in court, and I've arranged through the sheriff to let you shower on Monday morning. Use soap, Darren. Your mother is bringing clothes. They'll let you change in the holding cell before we start jury selection." The words came at me in a frenzy. As I spent more and more time in isolation, I found it took a bit of time for my brain to be able to absorb and decipher spoken information. "Are you all right?" Grace said. "I'm fine. It just takes me a minute to get used to someone talking to me. I'll get the haircut. I'll shave. I'll use soap. I'll come in there looking like $1 million." She smiled, which was something I'd grown to love. A simple pleasure. "Are you ready?" she said.
"Are you?"
She nodded.
"I think so. I know so, actually. I'm as ready for this trial as I've ever been. I want to ask you about Sean one last time. He's your alibi, but I know how you feel about putting him on a witness stand. I just want to make sure."
We'd been through this before. I'd taken Sean fishing on the Tennessee riverbank the Thursday Jalen Jordan was killed. We'd been out there for about 4 hours, and I hadn't bought gas or been any place that would have captured my presence on tape. We'd checked into whether cell phone tower evidence would be gathered and introduced, but I hadn't made any calls, and the towers could only put me within a 20-mile radius. Jordan had been killed less than 20 miles from where I was fishing.
I'm not putting him through that.
He's 6. Clancy will chew him up.
I have to be honest, Darren. I'm concerned. I still don't know exactly how they're going to tie you to it, other than some of the things you said. I don't know what James Tipton's testimony will be. He's refused to talk to my investigator. He actually threatened to shoot him the last time he went to Tipton's house. I think Tipton might come in there and lie.
Why would he do that? Not only did I save his ass on the aggravated assault, I gave him $50,000 for nothing. He doesn't have a reason to lie about me.
Don't forget who we're dealing with.
You mean Clancy?
I've suspected him of coaching witnesses, of basically manufacturing testimony in the past, but I haven't been able to prove anything. He's so good at it that I haven't even been able to accuse him of any misconduct. But considering how much he hates you, nothing he does will surprise me.
He's going to railroad me into prison for the rest of my life, isn't he? I said. Pressure began to build in my chest, and I suddenly found it difficult to breathe. Grace noticed immediately and sat down beside me. She reached over and took my hand. Her touch was electric.
Take it easy,
she said.
Everything is going to be all right.
No, it isn't, I said. He's done this before. He's going to steamroll us.
You have to believe in the process.
Is that all you've got? Believe in the process? We're talking about the rest of my life, and my lawyer is feeding me platitudes.
I know you're hurting, Darren,
she said.
And I believe you when you say you didn't kill him. I really do. I don't know how Clancy is planning to prove you were on the trail that day, or how you might have known Jalen Jordan was going to be there, but the fact remains that you certainly did some questionable things. And we're going to have trouble explaining why that tree stand was in your garage if you're going to testify that you know very little about hunting and shooting. Defending you is going to be quite a challenge.
And now you're going to tell me that in spite of my stupidity, you're going to do the best you can, right?
That's right. I'll do my absolute best for you.
And then you'll go home. No matter how it turns out for me, you'll get to go home.
If it turns out badly, we'll keep fighting. I won't quit, Darren. I won't let them just throw you away forever.
I turned toward her. Her face was only inches away, her hand still clutching mine.
I'm afraid, Grace, I said. I hate to say that out loud. I hate to admit it to you, to myself, to anyone, but I'm really, really afraid.
Her face moved toward mine, and I closed my eyes, feeling ashamed that I'd admitted to being afraid. A few seconds later, I felt the pressure on my hand release, and she stood, walked to the door, and pressed the button so a guard would come and let her out of the cell.
I know you're scared,
she said.
So am I. But remember what I said? I won't desert you, Darren. No matter what happens next week, I won't ever quit.
The door clanked and opened, and suddenly she was gone. Chapter 30. Grace's cell phone rang and her eyes opened. She had drifted off to sleep on her bed, covered in notebooks and files and papers. Her laptop lay open next to her. She reached over and picked up the phone. The caller ID was blocked. It was 11:57 p.m. Darren's trial would begin in 9 hours.
Hello?
Your client is innocent, a male voice said.
There were fewer than half a dozen people who knew Jordan was heading for the trail that day, and your client wasn't one of them.
Who is this?
Grace said.
One of the people who knew.
The voice was gravelly and the words were slightly slurred. This was someone who was probably drinking, maybe a wacko, but maybe someone who was having an attack of conscience.
Tell me who you are,
Grace said.
It doesn't matter who I am. I'm not going to come forward and risk my career for you or for your client. Listen to me. After Jalen Jordan was stopped by the Knoxville police, and after those 2 pairs of underwear were found in his van and turned over to us, we put a surveillance net around him so tight he couldn't have picked his nose without us knowing about it.
So you knew he was going hiking?
He wasn't going hiking. He was running away.
He was going to get onto the Appalachian Trail and head north into New York. He wanted to disappear.
And you just let him go? Or did one of you shoot him?
Nobody on our side shot him. I don't care what you think or what you may have heard. The FBI doesn't murder people. Clancy was the one who made the decision to let him go. He made the call. It had to go up the chain a little ways, but a decision had to be made quickly, and they let him make it. We were going to get some people on the trail close to Jordan and make sure he didn't get away and didn't hurt anyone. But we didn't even have a chance to do that, because between the time we knew he was going and he actually went out to the trail, somebody else was able to get out there, get into position, and pick him off. We're only talking about an hour and a half here total. Somebody had to know exactly where he would be, and there's just no way your client could have been that person. If he'd been doing close surveillance on Jordan, we would have known about it because we were all over Jordan.
So what's the bottom line?
Grace said.
Why are you calling me?
Bottom line? Clancy is your man. He's behind this. Figure out what he did, and your boy walks away.
But I can't go off half-cocked and accuse an assistant United States attorney of being involved in a murder without some kind of solid proof. They'll take my license, maybe put me in jail.
I know you can't. But I thought it might help if you at least knew your client didn't do it. Maybe Clancy will slip up, open a door for you.
Clancy doesn't slip up.
Then all I can tell you is that after your boy is sent away for life, keep digging. Eventually, maybe you'll find what you're looking for.
Chapter 31. The United States of America versus Darren Street began the following Monday morning at precisely 9 o'clock. By noon the next day, a jury had been picked. When we came back after the lunch break and Judge Gere asked Ben Clancy to make an opening statement, he said, "The United States waives its opening statement," which meant he intended to hide his strategy from us to the very end and let the case play out in front of the jury. Grace stood, and for the next half hour, she began the process of trying to soften the blow of what I'd done. I'd hired a hitman and then reneged, she said. I'd paid him in Jalen Jordan's own money and left the money with him. Yes, I'd made some ill-advised threats, but I'd done so under great duress. The victim had threatened my son, and I had reason to believe he would follow through. But I was innocent of the charge. I did not shoot Jalen Jordan. I could not have known he was on the trail that day. I did not own a rifle, nor had I fired one more than a few times during my entire life. I was innocent. 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 Ben Clancy began his parade of witnesses with the man who'd found Jalen Jordan's body. He described the body's position, and a couple of photos were introduced. Then came the uniforms. The first responders, who described the scene in further detail. Next up was the first FBI agent on the scene. He identified Jalen Jordan. Then came the medical examiner, who told everyone what they already knew. The man was dead. He described in detail the massive damage inflicted by the Winchester 270 bullet that tore through Jalen Jordan's heart. Clancy was excellent, I had to admit it. He was thoroughly prepared and didn't let the trial drag. He got to the point quickly with each witness, elicited the testimony he wanted, and then shut his mouth and sat down. Grace cross-examined the witnesses, but there really wasn't much to question. She was establishing a rapport with the jury, though, and I liked what I saw. She was attractive, confident, polite, and articulate. During her opening statement, she'd made it a point to walk over to me and put her hand on my shoulder, thereby showing the jury she didn't think I was a killer, that she wasn't afraid of me. She repeatedly called me Mr. Street instead of the defendant, an elementary trial tactic used by defense lawyers to humanize their clients, and I felt that overall, she'd done a good job of downplaying the evidence that had been introduced by the end of the first day. Clancy hadn't yet tied me to anything, and I walked out of court and went back to the jail, feeling a tiny glimmer of hope. To begin the day on Tuesday, Clancy called a crime scene expert, who reconstructed the killing for the jury. There was a great deal of scientific testimony about bullet velocities and trajectories and the use of a bullet trajectory laser. The expert testified that Jalen Jordan was shot by someone who was sitting in a tree stand. They found marks left by the stand in the bark of the tree trunk and introduced photos, approximately 24 feet off the ground at a distance of 103 yards away. Grace attempted to cross-examine him about the skills it would take to put a bullet in someone's heart from that distance, but the judge cut her off, ruling that the questions were outside the witness's field of expertise. The crime scene expert was followed by an FBI agent who had found a rifle in a creek bed not far from the crime scene. The rifle was a Ruger 270 with a stainless steel barrel and high-powered Leupold scope. I'd never seen it before. The FBI agent, whose name was Riley, said he had learned through his investigation that the gun was originally purchased from a gun dealer in Maryville by a man named Carl Jones 10 years earlier.
"Did you speak with Mr. Jones?"
Ben Clancy asked Riley.
I did not. Mr. Jones died 3 years ago. I went to the address we had listed for him and spoke to his widow. She told me she sold the gun to a friend of her husband's named Bill Miller 3 months after her husband passed away.
Clancy handed the agent a piece of paper.
"Will you identify this document for the jury, please, Agent Riley?"
"It's a bill of sale for the rifle from Mrs. Jones to Bill Miller. It says she sold the rifle to him for $300.
"And what did you do next?"
"I contacted Bill Miller."
"And what was the result of your contact with Mr. Miller?"
"Pretty much the same thing," the agent said. "Mr. Miller said he sold the gun to a friend and fellow hunter."
Clancy held up another document.
"And will you identify this document, please?"
"It's another bill of sale. This one from William Miller to James Tipton, Jr. It says Mr. Miller sold the rifle to Mr. Tipton for $200 2 years after he bought it from Mrs. Jones."
"And finally, Agent Riley, did you participate in a search of the defendant's home the night he was arrested?"
"I did."
Clancy held up a photograph and asked the bailiff to hand it to Riley.
"Would you identify this photo, Agent Riley?"
"Yes. This is a photo of the tree stand we found in the defendant's garage. It was located behind a sheet of plywood against the south wall."
"And does this photo depict the tree stand as you found it in the garage?"
"It does."
Clancy then turned and picked up a tree stand from beside his table.
"And is this the tree stand you found in the defendant's home, Agent Riley?"
The bailiff handed the stand to Riley.
"Yes, this appears to be it."
Clancy asked the judge to introduce both the photo and the tree stand into evidence, and the judge did so.
"Thank you, Agent Riley," Clancy said. "Please answer Ms. Alexander's questions."
Grace leaned over and whispered in my ear.
"Okay, for once and for all, do you swear to me you've never seen that rifle?"
"Never," I said. She stood and moved to the lectern.
"Agent Riley, during your search of Mr. Street's home, did you find any documentation that Mr. Street had ever purchased a tree stand? No receipts, credit card statements, things of that nature?"
"No, we didn't."
"And I assume you looked thoroughly. That would have been a nice little piece of corroboration, wouldn't it?"
"I think it's a pretty solid piece of evidence on its own."
"Were my client's fingerprints on it?"
"No."
"DNA?"
"No."
"And do you have any way of proving that this particular tree stand is the same tree stand that was used during Jalen Jordan's murder?"
"The measurements match up generally with the marks on the tree, but we can't definitively say it was the same tree stand that the murderer used, no."
"Thank you. And in your search of Mr. Street's home and office, did you find any other single piece of evidence that would implicate him in this killing?"
"Nothing that I'm aware of."
"Now, moving to the rifle, were Mr. Street's fingerprints on it?"
"No."
"DNA?"
"No."
"And your investigation revealed that the rifle used to kill Mr. Jordan passed from a gun dealer to a man named Carl Jones, who subsequently died, correct?"
"That's right."
"And then Mr. Jones's widow sold it to a man named Bill Miller, correct?"
"Correct."
"And then Mr. Miller sold it to a man named James Tipton?"
"Yes."
And you have bills of sale proving this chain of ownership?
We do.
And the chain of ownership stops with Mr. Tipton, correct?
Not exactly.
The tone in his voice caused me to sit up immediately. I wanted to stop Grace, to get her attention, to tell her to be careful. Something was up. She was about to be snagged in a trap.
I don't understand,
Grace said.
Do you have further documentary proof that the rifle changed hands again?
We don't have documentary proof, but we have other proof.
Don't ask him anything else, I thought. Stop right now and sit down.
Proof of what?
That the rifle changed hands again. James Tipton sold it to your client 2 days before Jalen Jordan was murdered.
There was a gasp in the courtroom, followed by an extended murmur. My head dropped involuntarily, and I felt as though I was deflating.
I move to strike his answer,
Grace said.
On what grounds? Judge Gear said.
Since the agent obviously has no documentary proof, his answer must be grounded in hearsay. He's repeating what he heard from Mr. Tipton. It's inadmissible.
She led him right to it,
Clancy said from his table.
And besides, Mr. Tipton is on the witness list. He's going to testify that he sold the rifle to Mr. Street. We also have an expert who is going to tie Mr. Street to the money he paid for the rifle through fingerprint evidence.
So that was it. The big lie that would convict me. The essential piece of the puzzle that Clancy needed to put me on the convict train. They were saying I bought the murder weapon from James Tipton 2 days before Jalen was shot. I felt like I was going to vomit.
I'm going to withhold ruling on your objection until I hear these other witnesses the government is planning to call,
the judge said to Grace.
Technically, I suppose you're right about the statement being hearsay, but if they put on the evidence they say they're going to put on, I believe the issue is moot.
Grace nodded and looked back at the agent.
I don't have anything further for this witness, she said.
That was how the second day ended. I walked out of court in a shock-induced daze. Up to that point, I hadn't really believed Clancy would be able to tie me directly to the murder. But he'd done it, and in spectacular fashion. Chapter 32. Grace came to my cell that night around 8. She looked as though her favorite pet had just been run over by a car.
I'm sorry, Darren, she said as soon as she walked in. I can't believe I made such a stupid mistake.
I knew what she was referring to. She'd asked the FBI agent, Agent Riley, a question when she didn't know the answer. It was a cardinal sin for a trial lawyer. You simply don't ask witnesses questions, especially on cross-examination, to which you don't know the answers. Doesn't matter, I said. Clancy was right. They were going to get it in through Tipton eventually. All Riley did was speed up the process.
And create an oh my god moment in front of the jury. He might as well have hit me in the face with a shovel.
She was right about that. It had been one of those rare moments in a court proceeding where everyone in the room was figuratively knocked off their feet.
I guess the circumstances could have been better, I said.
If we'd known it was coming, we could have tried to lessen the blow a little. But we didn't have any way of knowing.
We should have gotten to Tipton.
You know how it is, Grace. Prosecution witnesses don't have to talk to defense lawyers in criminal cases.
He's going to lie, isn't he?
Of course he's going to lie. I didn't buy that rifle from him, and I've never seen that tree stand in my life. The question at this point is, why is he lying? And the answer has to be that Clancy is coercing him somehow. He has something on James, something that must terrify him. He's one of those old-school thugs, or at least he used to be. One of those guys who would rather cut off an arm than talk to the police. Have you checked him out thoroughly? Grace shrugged.
As thoroughly as we can, I suppose, she said. I followed up on everything you've told me. My investigator has poked around some. Tipton's grandmother is apparently some kind of mob barker or something. The story is that she and her grandsons run an oxycodone smuggling operation from her farm in Sevier County. But we haven't been able to get anything out of the DEA about a drug investigation into Tipton or his family. I talked to Clancy right before I came here, and he swears there is no drug case pending against anyone in Tipton's family, and that they haven't offered Tipton anything in return for his testimony. The only reason he got involved was because they traced the rifle back to him.
I wonder if Tipton killed Jordan, I said. And if he did, why? Grace shook her head and sat down next to me on the bunk.
I don't even want to think about the answer to that question, she said. Because it's just so frightening. Is Ben Clancy capable of manipulating all of this? Could he possibly have set all of this in motion just to frame you for a murder?
You're damned right he's capable, I said. I think he's a straight-up sociopath.
Then may God help us, Grace said, because the legal system isn't going to.
Chapter 33 Clancy's first witness the next morning was a ballistics expert who testified that the bullet that killed Jalen Jordan was fired from the rifle that James Tipton had supposedly sold to me. The testimony was almost entirely well-established science. There was nothing Grace could do to refute it. After the ballistics expert was excused, Clancy began the process of methodically stepping on my throat. My paralegal and secretary, Rachel, was trembling and nearly in tears when she described the encounter with Jalen Jordan in my office that day. How she brought me a fee contract and placed $50,000 in the office safe, only to bring the money back to me later and see me tear the contract into pieces. She described me as extremely upset and admitted to Ben Clancy that I answered a question she asked me about Jalen Jordan with before or after I kill him. Grace objected on the grounds that the evidence was hearsay, but the judge allowed it as an excited utterance, which is an exception to the rule against hearsay. Grace tried to cauterize the wound by having Rachel tell the jury what a wonderful guy I was, but it didn't seem to work well. My old friend, Knoxville Police Captain Bob Ridge, reluctantly testified that I was highly agitated when I spoke with him on the phone, and that I told him my son had been threatened by Jalen Jordan. Same objection, same ruling. When Grace cross-examined him, Bob took the opportunity to tell the jury how highly he thought of me. It seemed to sit better with the jury than Rachel's remarks, and for a few moments at least, I once again felt a tiny glimmer of hope. Officer Olivia Denton testified that I called her and told her my son had been threatened by Jalen Jordan. She met with me, she said, and during the meeting I told her that I was going to have to deal with him outside the system. Grace again objected on the grounds that the evidence was hearsay, but the judge again allowed it, calling it an excited utterance and a statement against interest. A pattern was developing. Grace wasn't able to do anything else with Officer Denton, because the judge had ruled before the trial that any mention of the underwear found in Jalen Jordan's van was inadmissible. When he made the ruling, I knew he was right, but at that moment, I wished we could turn the jury's attention to what a scumbag Jalen was. We desperately needed to stop the bleeding. Next up was my beloved Katie, looking perfectly cosmopolitan in her designer duds.
"State your name, please," Clancy said.
"Caitlin Street. I go by Katie."
"And what is your relationship to the defendant, Mrs. Street?"
"I'm married to him for the time being, but I filed for divorce right after he was arrested. The court has delayed the divorce until this trial is over, but as soon as it's over, I'll be changing my name back to Caitlin Reese, which was my name before we were married."
"And you and Mr. Street have a child together, correct?"
"Yes. His name is Sean. He's 6 years old, almost 7.
"Miss Street, do you recall a day back in April when you received a telephone call from your husband regarding a threat that had been made against your son?"
"I'll never forget it," Katie said. "Darren threatened to strangle me with his bare hands." "Objection," Grace said. "Hearsay."
"Sustained," the judge said. "Is it fair to say that your husband was upset during that phone call?"
Clancy said.
"I've never heard him more upset," Katie said. "And believe me, I've heard him say some crazy things."
"What did your husband want when he called?"
"He wanted me to walk out of my job and go to Sean's school and pick him up. He said Sean had been threatened by some man who came to his office."
"Did you go immediately and pick up your son?"
"No, of course not. Darren has a tendency to overreact to things. He goes nuts sometimes, and he's overprotective of Sean. Darren's father was hard on him, so he's the opposite with Sean. He won't discipline him or anything."
"So after you told him you weren't going to pick up Sean that day, what happened?"
"You mean after he threatened to come to my work and strangle me with his bare hands?" "Objection," Grace said.
"Sustained. Disregard the answer, Judge Gere said to the jury. What happened after you hung up?
He disappeared for 3 days. That's what happened, Katie said. He took Sean with him. This was on a Tuesday, and I didn't see either one of them again until Friday night.
And Mr. Jordan was murdered that Thursday?
Yes, I think so.
Where did your husband go?
I have no idea. I think maybe he was hiding.
But he returned on Friday?
Yes.
Thank you, Mrs. Street.
Grace approached the lectern. Before she got there, she said,
You're a liar, aren't you, Mrs. Street?
Objection, Clancy said. Argumentative.
Let me rephrase that, Grace said. You're dishonest, aren't you?
Same objection.
Okay, let's try this. And before Mr. Clancy starts objecting, let me just say that these questions go directly to Mrs. Street's credibility. You're an adulteress, aren't you, Mrs. Street? You were having an affair with a man named Leonard Bright for several months before your husband was arrested for this crime, were you not? I don't see how that's any of your business, Katie said. Will the court instruct Mrs. Street to answer the question, please? Were you or were you not having an affair with a man named Leonard Bright for several months prior to your husband being arrested for this crime?
Answer the question, ma'am, Judge Gere said.
Darren was insensitive, Katie said. Is that a yes? He called me names. So you're an adulteress. You admit that. You were dishonest and were sneaking around with another man during your marriage. We're getting a divorce. I was the one who filed. Yes, and you had the divorce papers served on your husband right outside the courtroom following his initial appearance. Isn't that right? Mr. Clancy was the one who suggested that, she said.
I turned and looked at Clancy, who had suddenly become fascinated with his tie clasp.
Can you tell the jury of one instance when your husband has been violent toward you or your son, or anyone else for that matter? He told me he beat his father up and threw him out of the house when he was a teenager, Katie said. That was to protect his mother and himself from being beaten, wasn't it? You took an oath to tell the whole truth, Mrs. Street. I don't know if he or his mother were beaten. I wasn't there. Back in April, after your son was threatened, you say your husband disappeared and you didn't see him for 3 days. Is that correct? That's right. But it isn't true, is it? You saw him on Wednesday afternoon. He had taken Sean into hiding because he was concerned by the threat Jalen Jordan had made, and he came to your home to talk to you about it. And during that conversation, didn't you mention something about suing the FBI if your son was killed?
I kept glancing at the jury, and they were looking at Katie like she was a bug they wanted to squash. It was a small victory, but at least it was a victory, and Grace seemed to be genuinely relishing the opportunity.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about, Katie said. Fine. Just so the jury understands, your husband called you, upset that someone had threatened your son, and asked you to pick your son up at school. You refused because you said the place where you work was having a sale and you didn't want to leave. He was overreacting. How could you possibly know that? Because that's what he does, especially when Sean is involved. He loves his son very much, doesn't he?
Grace said.
I don't know. I guess he does. And he was only trying to protect him, wasn't he? I don't know. He's been a good husband, a good father, a good provider, hasn't he? He's spent a great deal of time with Sean. I don't know what you want me to... And yet, you filed a petition to terminate his parental rights. Isn't that true? He's a murderer, Katie said. I don't want him anywhere near Sean. He isn't a murderer unless the jury finds him guilty, Grace said. You, on the other hand, are already guilty of being one of the worst people I've ever had the displeasure of cross-examining. Nothing further.
Chapter 34. Katie was followed by Richie Fells, and it was all I could do to keep from leaping over the table and pummeling him right there in front of the judge and jury.
Would you tell the jury about your encounter with Mr. Street on the day in question?
Ben Clancy said.
He called my secretary and demanded to see me immediately, Fells said. And then he came storming in like he owned the place. He walked into my office and dropped $100 bill on my desk, apparently in hopes of buying my silence.
Objection. Speculation.
Grace barked.
Sustained. Before we go any further, Mr. Fells, I'd like to give the jury some sense of your background. You've been practicing criminal defense law exclusively for how many years?
Nearly 38, Ritchie said.
I've published several articles in various law journals and have also written a textbook on ethical issues in criminal cases. I've tried hundreds of cases in my career, everything from first-degree murder to driving under the influence. I'm listed in several publications as one of the top-rated criminal defense lawyers in the country.
And you've been friends with the defendant for quite some time, haven't you?
Yes. Darren came to me several years ago and asked me to help with an appellate case involving his uncle. I agreed, and we became friends. I've admired his work.
And just in the interest of full disclosure, in that case you referred to a second ago that involved Mr. Street's uncle, I was the prosecutor. I was on the other side.
Correct.
And you won. You secured Mr. Street's uncle's release from prison.
We did.
So you don't exactly have an axe to grind with Mr. Street, do you?
No, I certainly don't. I'm here only because I believe it is the right thing to do.
All right, then. Will you please continue telling the jury about your encounter with Mr. Street on that Tuesday afternoon?
He came in and dropped $100 on my desk. It was obvious that he was quite distraught. He told me a breathless story about a man who came in his office seeking representation, who wound up threatening his son. He believed the threat to be legitimate and wanted advice on what he should do. I told him if he thought the threat was genuine, he should take his son somewhere out of harm's way until he could get the police involved, or until the threat was contained in some other way.
And how did he respond?
He said he was thinking of killing the man.
Grace sprang to her feet and objected, but just as he had throughout the trial, Judge Gere found an exception to the hearsay rule and allowed the statement to stand.
Please continue, Clancy said.
I again told him I thought he should simply move the boy, but he said, Ritchie, you know I'm not wired like that.
Was there anything else?
Not really. He left shortly thereafter. The last thing I told him before he walked out the door was not to kill anyone, but then, just a couple of days later, I saw that this man had been shot, and I realized it was the same man Darren had been talking about. I made some calls to the Board of Professional Responsibility in Nashville and talked to the good folks there about my ethical responsibilities in this situation, and we agreed that it was my duty to come forward. So I called the FBI, and now here I am.
Grace moved to the lectern a couple of minutes later. I told her what an ass Ritchie had been, and I knew she wasn't pleased. She told me she was looking forward to going after him.
There's a long history of deep animosity between Mr. Clancy and my client, isn't there? She said.
Objection, Clancy said. I fail to see the relevance of my relationship with the defendant.
He brought it up, Judge. He opened the door when he asked about the appellate case.
I'll allow it for a short time, the judge said. Tight leash, Miss Alexander.
The fact that Mr. Street was infuriated by Mr. Clancy's conduct during Mr. Clancy's prosecution of Mr. Street's uncle, correct?
Darren was quite upset, yes.
In fact, he was so upset that he dedicated himself to helping Mr. Clancy's opponent in the next election for the District Attorney General, and Mr. Clancy lost by a narrow margin, isn't that right?
I suppose it is.
So if there's anyone in this trial with an axe to grind, it's Mr. Clancy, correct?
That's enough, Miss Alexander, the judge said. Move on.
It's also correct that you have grossly exaggerated your testimony, isn't it? You've taken Mr. Street's comments to you entirely out of context.
Oh, that isn't true, Ritchie said.
You've already said Mr. Street was upset. He was upset because Jalen Jordan had threatened to kill his son and throw him off a cliff, isn't that right?
I believe he said something like that, yes.
And this threat had been made within just a couple of hours of Mr. Street's visit to your office?
I believe so.
And he came to you because he believed you to be a friend, correct? He trusted you?
I think he did.
You were friends, weren't you?
Probably more colleagues than friends, but we knew each other.
He told you he'd given some thought to killing Jalen Jordan, correct?
He did.
But you didn't take him seriously, did you?
I was concerned.
Really? Why didn't you call the police?
I don't know. I didn't really see it as my place to call the police.
You didn't go to the FBI until after Mr. Street had been arrested, did you, Mr. Fells?
I believe it was a couple of days after they picked him up, right.
And a couple of days after you spoke to Mr. Street at the jail. He wanted to hire you, didn't he? He wanted his old friend, a man he trusted, to represent him in this case.
His mother called me and asked me to come to the jail.
And you told him you would need a minimum of $200,000 to take the case, correct?
I don't remember the exact fee I quoted.
Why, because you were drunk?
Objection!
Clancy said.
Sustained.
The truth is that you came to the jail and asked for an extremely high fee. Mr. Street thought you were his friend and would find a way to work something out, but you weren't willing to do that. So the two of you got into an argument and you left, correct?
It is true that I left. I certainly did.
And after the argument, you suddenly had an attack of self-righteousness, called the FBI, and have now come into a federal courtroom and exaggerated, if not outright lied, because Mr. Street ruffled your feathers. Isn't that correct?
Objection!
Clancy shouted.
That's enough, Ms. Alexander, the judge said.
Fine. I'm finished, Grace said. You're some friend, Mr. Fells. And I want it on the record that I'm filing a disciplinary complaint against you for violating the attorney-client privilege and for committing perjury here today. She turned away from the lectern and sat down next to me. I could feel the heat coming off her. We were probably losing the trial, but Grace was definitely finding her courage. Fells was the last witness of the day, and by the time he was finished testifying, I could barely stand up to walk out of the courtroom. I looked for my mother, but she was being sequestered outside the courtroom because she was to be a witness, my only witness, besides me. There was no one else in the courtroom who was on my side. Uncle Tommy was dead, and our small family had been fractured and separated by my father's alcoholism many years ago. My father, too, was dead, having run a car into the trunk of an oak tree 2 years after I kicked him out of our home. I hadn't spoken to him in the interim and didn't attend his funeral. I'd never felt so alone. Chapter 35. When they came for me the next morning, I felt like I was being led to the gallows. I knew James Tipton would be the first person on the stand, and I knew what he was going to say. I just didn't know why. As soon as court was convened and everyone was settled, the clerk called Tipton's name. He walked in looking uneasy and out of place in a brown suit. Clancy.
State your name for the jury, please.
Tipton.
James Tipton, Jr.
Clancy.
Mr. Tipton, are you familiar with the defendant, Darren Street?
Tipton.
Yes, sir.
Clancy.
Tell the jury how you know him.
Tipton.
He was my lawyer when I was charged with aggravated assault a couple of years ago. We ended up taking it all the way to a trial, and the jury found me not guilty last year. He and I became friends. He's even been up to my home a couple of times.
Clancy.
So how do you feel about Mr. Street now? Do you like him?
Tipton.
I like him a lot. He's a good man and a good lawyer. I feel real sorry for him, though. I hate that he put himself in this spot.
Clancy.
I suppose it's probably difficult for you to testify here today, then. Is it not?
Tipton.
Very difficult.
Very hard.
Clancy.
Mr. Tipton, back on April 16th of this year, did you see the defendant?
Tipton.
I did.
Clancy.
How did that come about?
Tipton.
He showed up at my house around 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening.
Clancy.
Were you expecting him?
Tipton.
Nope. He showed up out of the blue. My dog started barking, and I looked outside and saw a minivan. So I went out onto the porch, and Darren hollered at me.
Clancy.
Tell the jury about the encounter you had with the defendant.
Grace stood up and objected that Tipton's testimony was unreliable and inadmissible hearsay. Clancy countered that the things Tipton was going to testify to were admissible because they were statements against interest, another exception to the hearsay rule that allows witnesses to repeat statements they heard if the statements were supported by corroborating circumstances and would tend to expose the person who made them to criminal liability. The judge agreed with Clancy. Clancy.
Go ahead, Mr. Tipton.
Tipton.
Well, like I said, he kind of showed up out of nowhere. He came in the house and we sat down at the kitchen table. He seemed a little upset, so I asked him if he'd like a beer or maybe a shot of moonshine, and he said he would. So I got us both a beer and grabbed a jar of moonshine out of the freezer. He took a couple of long pulls of the moonshine and drained a beer real quick and asked me for another one. So I asked him if something was wrong, and he said this man had come to his office and tried to hire him. He said the man gave him $50,000 for what Darren thought was a pretty minor case at first. But he said he needed the money, so he took it. Then he tells me that during the conversation, the man tells him that he's the guy that killed those two little boys they found out by the sinks, and just a few minutes later, he threatened to kill Darren's son.
Clancy.
Stop right there, Mr. Tipton. I move to strike the last sentence and ask the court to instruct the jury to disregard what the witness just said.
The court.
I can't unring the bell, Mr. Clancy. He's your witness. You were supposed to instruct him.
Clancy.
I did, Your Honor. I went over this very thoroughly with him.
The court.
Mr. Tipton, you will make no further reference to the boys who were found. They have nothing to do with this trial. If you mention them again, I'll jail you for contempt. Is that understood?
Tipton.
Yes, sir.
The court.
Continue, Mr. Clancy.
Clancy.
At some point in the conversation, did Mr. Street ask you for something?
Tipton.
He did. He asked if I had a rifle I'd sell him.
Clancy.
And what did you say?
Tipton.
I said, Darren, you're my friend. If you need a rifle, I'll sell you one, but don't tell me what you're going to do with it.
Clancy.
Did you eventually sell Mr. Street a rifle?
Tipton.
I did.
Clancy.
And how did you happen to come by this rifle in the first place, Mr. Tipton?
Tipton.
I bought it from a buddy of mine I used to hunt with by the name of Bill Miller.
Clancy. Shows the witness the rifle previously entered into evidence.
Is this the rifle you sold to Mr. Street?
Tipton.
It appears to be.
Clancy.
How much did Mr. Street pay you for this rifle, Mr. Tipton?
Tipton.
He paid me $5,000 in $100 bills.
Clancy.
Didn't you think that was a little expensive for a rifle?
Tipton.
I did. I told him as much, but he insisted. He said he'd gotten it from the man who came into his office and didn't want it.
Clancy.
What happened to that money, Mr. Tipton?
Tipton.
I turned it over to you all when you came around accusing me of killing Jaylen Jordan.
Clancy. Showing the witness a stack of bills.
Does this appear to be the money Mr. Street paid you?
Tipton.
I can't say that's it for sure, but it looks like it.
Clancy.
So let's get this all straight for the jury, all right? You initially purchased the rifle from a friend of yours named Bill Miller. Mr. Street came to you in April. He was upset and told you this story. Then he asked if you would sell him a rifle. You agreed, and he paid you $5,000. He left, and you didn't see the rifle again until a week later when you were picked up and questioned by FBI agents after Jaylen Jordan was murdered. At that time, you admitted that you'd bought the rifle from Bill Miller, told the agents you'd sold it to Darren Street, and turned over the money he paid you for the rifle. Is that correct?
Tipton.
That's about it. Yes, sir.
Clancy.
Had you used the rifle recently, Mr. Tipton?
Tipton.
Not since hunting season, back in December.
Clancy.
Do you know whether the scope was aligned properly? Was it zeroed in, as they say?
Tipton.
The scope was zeroed. I keep all my weapons in perfect shape.
Clancy.
Thank you, Mr. Tipton.
Grace didn't even pick up her notes. She went straight to the lectern and stared at Tipton for a long minute.
You committed this murder, didn't you, Mr. Tipton?
She said. James's shoulders dropped, and he folded his hands in his lap. I didn't know what he'd expected when he walked into the courtroom, but Grace's posture and the tone of her voice very quickly told him it wasn't going to be pleasant.
No, ma'am, James said. Mr. Street came to you and originally offered you $50,000 to kill Mr. Jordan, didn't he?
No.
He gave you the money, too. He didn't give you $5,000. He gave you $50,000. Where's the other $45,000, Mr. Tipton?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Mr. Street came to you originally because he knew you had violent tendencies. You've been known to cut people up with knives, haven't you?
I was acquitted of that charge.
But you still cut a man so badly that almost 300 stitches were required to close the knife wounds. Isn't that right?
It was self-defense.
How many other people have you cut up, Mr. Tipton?
I haven't been charged with anything else.
How many others have you cut up? How many others besides Jalen Jordan have you killed?
None. I haven't killed or cut up anybody. And I didn't kill Jalen Jordan.
Mr. Street knew you were capable of violence. He was frightened for his son, so he came to you and asked you to commit a killing. It was a mistake. And he realized that quickly and came back first.